So before we quickly go through what we did towards the end of the lecture yesterday, there were a few questions from yesterday's lecture, and they're quick to address, so I'll do them right now. A very, very good question, that path integral formulation, which we did, was for time-independent Hamiltonian. And if Hamiltonian is time-dependent, then, of course, we have to go through all that time ordering and stuff because there are n-fold integrals involved here. So that's a good question. And one question was regarding the definition of observables in terms of the density matrices. I don't exactly understand the question, but it says this is equal to trace of rho A. Is it a definition or a defined quantity? I exactly don't know what it means, but what this tells us is that if I want to find expectation value for any operator, I just need the density matrix for that system. I multiply the matrix with the matrix for my observable. We get a new matrix, and we just find the trace. The trace is going to give me this expectation value. Okay. And then there was a question, what is the quantitative measure of decoherence? It's a really nice question, which made me think. And I need to think more before giving you a clear cut answer for it, okay? Is this a measure of decoherence? This is definitely a measure of a system, whether it's pure or mixed. And pure systems are cohered. Maybe Paul is, can you answer that? Is it a, I mean, your experience with the density matrix formulation, I can guess. Is trace of rho square a measure of decoherence?
It's a measure of purity.
Yes.
So if trace of rho square is equal to 1, that means it's on the block sphere. If rho square is 3 square, less than 1, so it's inside the block sphere. So if it's inside the block sphere, that's a mixed state. But we cannot always say that it's in the tangled state because, if it's part of the system where we take a partial trace and then we get a mixed state matrix, then we say that okay, the whole system is in a tangled system. But it's like that. But we can't really say that if it's a mixed state.
But how about the decoherence? Does it give us any information about decoherence? Because decoherence is somehow related to mixed state as well, but not always.
Yeah.
So I need to think more about this.
Yeah. It's not. Maybe you can say that this quantity is like basis independent.
Yes.
Like the trace or something. Is it this? Yes. And coherence looks like it is something that depends on your choice of measurement basis.
Yes, it does.
Not really.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's. I agree with that. That decoherence is definitely dependent on the basis you are looking at. You could always diagonalize your matrix, and you could do that. But still, let me give my opinion after thinking for a while on this question. And I have also promised you a write-up for the Revival Times. Just to let you know, I haven't forgotten. Whenever I get time, I'll definitely post something related to that. Okay, so let's quickly go over, because number of you had questions related to the last part of the lecture, which we went through very quickly. What we were trying to do was, we were trying to find this amplitude, and this amplitude tells me if my state changed from like what's the probability, if I take modulus square of this quantity, it gives me probability that my system changed from QI to QF over a period of capital T. And one question, very interesting question was, what's the intuition behind using infinite slits and infinite screens? Why are we using that approach? The intuition is that we are not considering any path special, okay? We are not saying that this transformation has taken from QI to QF along a straight line. We don't know. That might be a preferred path. Or like this, or like this. We don't know which path the system has taken when it changed from QI to QF. So in order to include all the possibilities, all the paths it could have taken, we assumed infinite slits, because infinite slits, invisible slits, give you an option that the particle could have taken any path to reach QF. Okay, I hope that is clear. So what we did with this, again, what we want to see is, we want to see how the system slowly propagates from QI to QF over a period of time. That's why we divided into small steps of time. And then at every step, we inserted this identity. And we got something like this. So what was of our interest was this matrix element here, single individual factor, because they all look similar. So if we can calculate one, we'll substitute back it in here in the star and see how this probability amplitude looks like. Okay. So the last part was more calculating this individual factor. I probably don't need this. And we were trying to do it for a very general Hamiltonian with a potential and a kinetic energy term. So if I substitute that in here for one of these individual factors, I can clearly see that Qj is an eigenstate of my Qs. So this vector is not a troublesome vector. It's easy to see, calculate. What's troublesome is the p square by 2m operator, because Q is clearly not an eigenstate for this operator. So we insert this identity over the momentum space or Fourier transform the space and use the fact, and there's some normalization constant which I don't remember. But anyways, this is the Fourier transform. I use the Fourier transform in here. This is clearly an eigenstate for P. So the operator form for PI, it goes away. And what's left is QJ and P, another plane wave form, which can be written like this. Okay. And this is nothing but a form of a Gaussian integral, which is integral over P here, but integral over X. And if I just replace this, delta T by QM I with A and J as the I QJ plus 1 QJ. So these integrals are, this integral is a Gaussian integral. If I make this substitution, I would see that the small individual element which I'm looking at simplifies to something in form of a Lagrangian, because this is nothing but Q dot square, and there should be an M as well. So M, Q dot square, and by 2. So something like a kinetic energy term minus a potential, which is kind of a Lagrangian in continuous limit. So if I substitute N of these, because there are N of these matrix elements, if I substitute N of these matrix elements in here, I'll get this as power of n, and n sums over all these exponentials, which is nothing but my Lagrangian. Is this much neater? Or still someone has some concerns with the writing part? Okay. So, I'll use projector for our lecture today. And part of the lecture where I'm doing heavy math, I'll just stop using projector, because it's much better to have the entire board for all these mathematical calculations. So this is the outline. Meanwhile, we covered general form. What today we are going to do is we are going to see how to interpret the end result we got and see from that result how can we see how quantum systems should behave, what path they should take, and how classical systems should behave, or what path classical systems should take, okay? And that should answer us that why classical systems, they choose the path of least action. That was our initial question, which we started with. And what's interesting to note here is that so in this integral A, which is the probability amplitude, so this is my A, and it depends on my time t. I have this infinite number of infinite possibilities for paths, and then I'm integrating over something called Lagrangian of the system, and Lagrangian is a classical quantity, right? So what, in a word, I'm doing is I'm trying to use a classical quantity like Lagrangian to quantize my system, which is clear from here, because this amplitude is a quantum mechanical probability, right? And what I'm doing is I'm expressing that in terms of a classical quantity called the Lagrangian. So if I have a classical Lagrangian, I just substitute it in here in the path integral formulation, and I have kind of quantized the system. It's one way of doing quantum mechanics, which is the reason I mentioned this is because when we are going to switch from particles, so this is a single particle evolution which we talked about yesterday. When we talk about fields instead of particles, we are going to do the exact same thing. We are going to talk about the Lagrangians of fields and then use that Lagrangian of field in our path integral formulation and then quantize our field, which is like quantum field theory, okay? So another notation which I'm going to use is that Z, and that Z here is again a probability amplitude, which tells me if my system was in ground state, after time capital T, it stayed in ground state, what is the probability of that? Okay, so we are going to extensively work with Z quantity, probably not in today's lecture, but just keep in mind A means any general evolution from QI to QF, and Z means vacuum to vacuum or ground state to ground state evolution. Okay, so what I'm interested in is interpreting my final result, which is this. What does it tell me? If you look at the definition of DQ, you'll see it has sum over all infinite paths which the particle could have taken, and then an amplitude factor attached to it. And this amplitude factor is independent of the path. So whatever path particle chooses, the amplitude of that probability would remain same. What is going to be different is this phase factor. This is a phase vector which we can represent on a circle. I think we have talked about it. So for one of the paths, let's say I have some probability amplitude which has and then there's a phase vector attached to it, and the phase vector depends on the action for this particular path, okay? And I get something like this. So this magnitude, so the I would say the length of the vector remains same, the magnitude is same, it's just the direction of the arrow which is changing for each of my path chosen, right? Do you agree? A different path, the magnitude remains same, but this vector is going to change, and I'll have an arrow in some other direction, okay? So the final amplitude which I'm getting is sum over all these paths, which means I'm summing over all the infinite vectors which I'm getting for each path, and then the final vector which I get gives me the probability amplitude. Is this thing clear? So whatever I just said, this here means that it has same magnitude, which is attached to this DQ factor, and different phases associated with each path. So I can call this quantity for each path as a vector, which has same magnitude, different direction. And by summing over all the phases from different paths, we should get the final amplitude. And A square should give me the probability of finding the particle at the final point. So let's see how many paths for a quantum system they contribute to the final amplitude A. So this is a quick question if you can do. You try it for a straight line path. So Lagrangian is given by this trajectory. Just substitute this Q in your Lagrangian. Find your exponential. Don't worry about the magnitude because it's same for all the paths we are choosing. And then do the same exercise for a parabolic path. Okay. So I have QI and I'm choosing two different paths that QI could have evolved to QF. One could be a straight line path and the other is a parabola about T. Can you quickly do and tell me what should be S? S is just integral over the Lagrangian. For both the paths, and then find the difference between both the actions. So this is a classical path which we think the particle should follow because it's a free particle, okay? And this is a kind of not a parabola exactly looks like in this picture, but it's a parabolic path. So Q by T square is Q prime. So Q prime here is the QF, okay? So this is Q prime in my picture. You should get something like this. And I can maybe show you quickly how one of these integrals is. I mean, it's just integral over time of this quantity. So for a straight line path, my Q is and if I calculate Q dot, this quantity, right, I just need to substitute this in my Lagrangian for free path, free particle, integrate it over time, and I'll get action like half mq prime square by t prime. And this integration is from 0 to t prime. So I'm just making the substitution. Qf has been replaced by Q prime, and t has been replaced by t prime. And similarly, you can do it for a parabolic path as well, right? You'll get this. Now, when you find the difference between the actions for two different paths, it's something like half m, the final q, squared by the final t. Let's calculate this quantity for a quantum mechanical particle, which is an electron. Okay? Just substitute all those constants m, h cross in here. What you'll get is 1 over 6 radians, which is a very, very small quantity, right? So, which means that if I'm calculating my phase from the straight line path, the classical one, so if I calculate the phase from here and using a different path, which is PR. For this, if I get something like this, a phase like this. For a path which is a little deviating from my classical path, it would look something like very close to the classical path phase, right? If I choose a path which is like really far from my classical path, in that case, very far, these phases would be randomly oriented. Okay, so what I am trying to say here is that for a quantum system, my phases are going to add up constructively if the path which I choose is not too far away from my classically predicted path. But if I choose a path which is like going to moon and coming back, the phases would be random. Okay, they won't constructively add to my classical path. And this is a like simulation or visualization that if I choose 30 different paths for my system to propagate from I to F, you see these spinners here would be oriented in different directions. So each of these vectors will be in a different direction. And this is for 50 paths. Let me give a screenshot. This is for 100 distinct paths. And do you notice a pattern here in the phases? So these are the arrows. What can you tell about?
It's an interference pattern.
It's a kind of interference pattern.
With diffraction.
Actually, there is no slit. And we are just looking at one. So I'm not looking at the entire screen. I'm just looking at the probability of finding it at one point. So when I add up all these vectors, I get probability at single point. In order to see the diffraction pattern, I need to find these arrows at each single point and then draw it, okay? But that's a good. So I'm adding all these, and whatever addition, vector addition I get, gives me the probability of finding the particle at one point, not at the entire screen, okay? Yeah.
So I think we can interpret this as the arrows that are pointing in similar directions, they will add up together. So we can say that the arrows that are pointing together, they add more contributions to the.
Exactly. And as you go away and away from your classically projected path, which is like straight line, all these arrows are spiraling around and they should cancel, right?
Would we still see some arrows that are aligned like far away from the center?
You choose more and more slits, you'll get the exact and exact result. It's just like, this is the best we could do. Vipul could do with 100 slits. Now, the end result would be I have to calculate the phases for each path, add them. You know, like it's just a vector, right? You can add vectors. And whatever vector you get in the end result is your final probability amplitude. And for quantum systems, what we see is that the paths which deviate like small from your classically predicted path, they still do contribute. But paths which are like far away from your classical path, they spiral around and they just cancel. And what you can see is here, this is a classically predicted paths arrow. And the paths which are like far, far, they spiral around, they don't contribute. And it's only the paths which are close to the classically predicted path, they add up constructively. Okay, this is for your quantum system. Can we do the same exercise for a classical system? So in classical system, this is a straight line path action for a parabola. Can you calculate the difference in these phases for two different paths? Your m, let's choose m to be 1 grams. For earlier, we did it for electrons, so m was really small. Now in this case, m is 1 grams, let's say. Should the quantity be big or small? That is more important as compared to the delta of S in quantum case. This S delta S should increase or decrease? It should increase, right? And the increase is really appreciable. So even if you deviate a little bit from your classically predicted path, the phases are randomly somewhere on your circle. So if this was the classical path, and you just deviate a bit from your classical path, the arrow is not constructively adding to your classical. It's randomly distributed on the circle. So now if I add up all the contributions, all contributions except for the classical would cancel. And the classical path is the path of least action, remember, right? So as I go into classical limits, which means my action is increasing, remember in my path integral, we missed a h cross. So there is an h cross quantity here, which I said I'll attach it to the end. So if this quantity here is much, much bigger than h cross, then even a small deviation from your straight line or classical path would be a randomly oriented phase. But for quantum systems, they are comparable for small deviations. Like if your deviation is really big, then this won't contribute. So all those infinite paths, if you add up, they actually reduce to one path, which is given by the classical Euler-Lagrangian equation. So let's see another animation. So in this picture, we are increasing S more and more, making it bigger and bigger, and S becomes more and more. You see the paths which are away from the classical, they are swirling around more and more. And what you get in the end is something like this. So all the other phases, they cancel. And only a few phases very, very close to classical path might contribute to it. Okay, really close. Like not even, you can say observed deviation from classical path. So to summarize, I would say that when we are trying to see how systems propagate or how states evolve with time, for classical, since my action is really big, it has the option of choosing any path with equal probability. But it's just how the phases they add up, that you just see one path, you assign one single path to your classical system. But for quantum systems, there are few more paths which are contributing to the total probability. Okay?
Yeah. For the classical particle example, could you explain how we were able to use the path integral formulation for a classical particle?
We won't be using that. So see, in the end, I didn't calculate the probability amplitude for classical, neither for quantum. What we were just saying was out of these, like if I had to see how classically these paths would look like for a classical system, that's all. I'm not calculating the, it doesn't make any sense to calculate this probability amplitude for classical systems, right? Because classical system, from here, we see that if I take the least action and derive the Euler-Lagrangian equation, it gives me a fixed, well-defined path for it. So it's not a probabilistic answer. Is that your question?
Yeah,
definitely there's no probabilistic answer for classical systems. Anything else? I'll give you a minute or two to think, and if you have questions. And yeah.
So we can derive the Euler-Lagrangian equation by stationary phase.
Yes. We'll do it for fields. For particles, I thought you might have already seen them in the classical physics course, like classical mechanics course. So for fields, we are going to derive the Euler-Lagrangian equation today. Yeah, we have time. So. I don't think there's a need for quick recap. And I still have to comment about yesterday's quote, that whatever is possible, like if there's a probability of something happening, it should happen. But as a physicist, as a scientist, it's our duty to see what could happen, because everything can't happen, right? So we'll come to that in today's lecture. But today's quote is by Dirac, who was one of the, formulators of quantum electrodynamics and quantum field theories. So he actually started this field in a way. But he said that a theory with mathematical beauty is more likely to be correct than an ugly one that fits some experimental data. And so he, although he was one of the inventors of the theory, he disliked the theory very much. Because he realized that this theory had some infinite, so when you try to calculate these path integrals, they tend to give infinities for some systems, which he wasn't happy about. A physical system shouldn't give you infinities. And eventually other scientists, they tried to get rid of the infinities using something called renormalization, which you'll cover in Dan's part. So using these tricks, like mathematical tricks, they tried to get the correct result, which matched the experiment, but still Dirac wasn't happy with all these tricks. According to him, theory should give you correct physical results without any mathematical tricks to it. So he, in later part of his life, he stopped contributing to this field, although he was one of the first few scientists who had kind of invented this, all right?
A quick question about the optical formulation. So in this case, we chose like position and momentum to be like our basis. So what if we chose some other property instead? So let's say spin as a function of time.
That's a good question.
Would that be like a valid formulation?
Yes. All you need to do is you change the basis. So like if I want to do it in some other basis, and this formulation is for Q. We just need to change your quantity which you want to calculate in this particular basis, that's all. Okay, so what's the problem with the quantum mechanical description? We are doing it for particles. But this quantum mechanical description, this or the Schrodinger-Heisenberg interaction picture, they can't answer some fundamental questions. Like for example, where do particles come from? Schrodinger equation doesn't tell you how particles were formed, right? Or how they live and how they die, how they appear and how they disappear kind of thing. They don't have any valid explanation about these reactions happening, a particle splitting into two or something like that, right? It has asymmetric treatment of space and time. Space is considered as an operator and time is taken as a parameter. It doesn't have an operator. Sometimes you treat light as particles, photons. And when you're talking about atom-light interaction, you take light as a wave, which doesn't make sense. So there should be a same formulation for that quantity. So there are some problems with quantum mechanics, some basic fundamental questions which it can't answer. For example, in here, when we were trying to calculate this matrix element, I never said that these QJs and J plus 1, they are events not happening outside the light cone, right? So I could have chosen these QJs and QJ plus 1 outside the light cone, which means that an event is happening faster than speed of light. All these formulation, it doesn't stop. So when I said that you have to take contributions for all the paths, it would mean something happening on Earth, but the probability is going to moon and then coming back, something of that sort, which doesn't make sense. Because the event has to happen within a fixed stipulated t time. So these events should not contribute. And as scientists, we should try to nullify those probabilities that, yeah, it couldn't happen. So if you look at such events which are happening with speeds faster than the speed of light in here, you see, if I could have chosen qj and q plus 1 outside the light cone, still it gave me a finite non-zero answer. So there's a probability of this happening in quantum mechanics, which shouldn't, right? So this is another one problem. Other questions which we asked during our first lecture, why all electrons are same? In this part of the universe, any other part of the universe, electrons have same mass, charge, exactly the same. There's no difference. Why some forces, they follow 1/r law, or they are attractive, or what? Why they are repulsive and so on. We can't answer them using quantum mechanics. So we need a different concept to explain, or maybe make an attempt to answer these questions. And this is where the concept of fields came into picture. So instead of talking about particles, something called field, which we are already familiar with, was given. The concept of field is very simple. It's really easy to visualize. For example, the temperature field in room. Each point in temperature in this field, temperature field, is would be called as the field point. And each field point could have some value, right? And this is an example of a scalar field, because temperature is a scalar quantity. But you could also have fields described using vectors. For example, the electromagnetic fields. And then spinners could describe electrons, because they have spins. And tensor fields, you are going to use in, I think, quantum gravity course. So tensor fields are used to describe the quantization of gravity, okay? And quant fields, I don't know. You can't quantize quant fields, I guess. So what are fields? Fields are quantity which are described by some field points, and each field point depends on the space-time coordinate. So here we were talking about a single point, single particle, q. Now we are going to switch to something called phi, which is field. And this field would depend on your space. Can I write? I don't know what I'm writing in my notes. I should use the same notation. I'm using x. Okay. Now, each field point, like this field here, I'm just visualizing the temperature field. Temperature field has different field points throughout this space spread. What we are going to consider is these scalar fields throughout our course. Okay. We won't talk about vectors or spinners or tensor fields. We're just going to talk about something called scalar fields, like the temperature. And when we are talking about the fields, each point in the space would be related to the points neighboring it. So the field points are not like independent to each other. Each point influences the point neighboring it. And that interaction or the potential within the field would be given by a quantity called f phi. Okay, it's a function of the field itself, phi. And the most general function to take is a polynomial. And in this polynomial function, the constant factor, we can ignore it. It's just the scaling of the field, right? The second linear in phi is a factor which produces, so if I apply this kind of potential within my field, so this is not a potential which I'm applying from outside, it's the potential within the field points inside the field, okay? So this factor here, it affects all the field points equally, like in the similar manner. So it doesn't actually produce any kind of effect which I'm interested in. So whatever effect it produces throughout the field. So there's no like, I would say, observable effect if I include this. So we are going to consider scalar fields with this kind of potential or interaction between field points, which start from m square phi square terms. Okay, this would be the harmonic term and the higher order and harmonicities in our field. Okay, let me give you a picture. So this is the picture how it looks like. Room, temperature field, each point in the room is a field point and it can have some value. So temperature at each point could have some value, okay? And each of these field points, they are not independent to each other, so they're talking. This field point, the temperature here, could influence the temperature at a neighboring point. So if I change the temperature of one point, it's going to influence the temperature of my neighboring points as well. So they are interacting. And the interaction is given by this term here. Is this thing clear? Okay. So let me see if I missed something. So imagine a discretized space. Each point is assigned a number represented by the field values. So each point has a field value at any instant of time. It's not just space, but also time I'm talking about. And each field point is connected through a potential within the field, which is given by Fi, which I showed in the previous slide. Okay, so if I change one of these field magnitude for the field points, it's going to influence the other points as well. Okay. So now what we are going to do is, as I said, that this path integral formulation is really interesting. What it does is you take a classical Lagrangian, put it in your path, and the system becomes quantized. So we are going to start with a Lagrangian for field, for classical fields, put it in the path integral formulation, and you'll get your quantum field theories. Okay? So first step would be to formulate Lagrangian for your field. That's what we are going to do next. Is things clear? Are things clear till here? Yeah.
Could you explain more about the potential of the field? I'm having trouble with it.
Yeah.
What it exactly means to define a potential of the
field. Within the field.
So, it is a function that is dependent on the value of the field. Should I?
It depends on the value of the field points, yes.
Okay.
Imagine number of harmonic oscillators. Okay, maybe a picture like this would be better. This is your field. These are your field points, and they're all connected to through springs. And the interaction between fields would mean if I move one of these springs, the others are going to move as well, because they are they are interacting with each other through that harmonic potential, right? Do you agree that if I move this point, it should influence these points as well? This is exactly what I'm talking about. And it is it depends on this field point phi, right? Where it's located.
So does it mean, so in the potential we have some power, phi to the one, or phi to phi squared phi cubed, kind of, what does the powers mean in terms of the potential?
How do you describe a harmonic potential? Right? And if I replace these points with fields.
Oh, I see. So, okay.
It's exactly.
It means that the value of the field in turn, the values of the field interact with each other harmonically. That makes sense.
Exactly. In here, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So it's just think like a bunch of oscillators, these springs connected to each other, and this is exactly how our field is behaving. And if you try to move one of the springs, the others are going to get disturbed as well. Okay.
Why do you call the order phi potential?
Phi is the field. It's not the potential.
You discarded the from the potential, you discard the order of 5.
Yes.
Why?
Just forget about the fields. If I tell that there are two harmonic, like there's an harmonic oscillator, how do you write the potential for an harmonic oscillator? There are like, it's a spring system.
Right.
How do you write the potential for this? Right? It depends on this distance.
Suppose we don't know anything about the field, so we don't know if it's harmonic, we don't know anything.
Yeah.
You mentioned that we put rid of the order 5 because it acts on every point the same. I don't really get that.
Okay, yeah. That's a good question as well. I'll give an analogy, not a very good one, but it'll make things much clearer. When we talk about such potentials in harmonic oscillator, so this potential can give me the force, right? The force is this, dependent on x. Can you calculate the force from this potential? It would be a constant force, right? If you calculate the force from this potential, just integrate it, it's a constant force. So kind of you have a field and you're just applying constant force at every field point. So it shouldn't give you any observable effects. That's why I said that we can ignore. It produces no variations in field or observable effects. It's like you have this field and then you kind of altogether lift it up. All the points at the same point, something like that. Yeah.
In the previous slide, I don't get the motivation behind introducing the potential as a polynomial equations.
What else could have been? That's like the generalized, maybe an exponential?
There could be many other mathematical structures. I don't know really what was in their mind when they introduced this polynomial equation as a general scale.
Yeah. Maybe we can look into the history and why a polynomial function is the most preferred one. But in the end, what we are going to see is.
Okay.
I was just thinking that the idea is like lambda gives work, right? The idea that you like pick your potential to the correct symmetry set. And that's the reason why they just like create a polynomial that fits like 5 cubed if they want to have some number of phases or.
Maybe you can describe it more, but I have something in my mind right now. What we want to describe is the potential within the field, how each field point is interacting with the other, right? And the nature of the field is going to depend on how many terms we take. And each of these terms, the reason why we are choosing polynomial is, that these terms, they give us the power to see how many neighboring terms are interacting with each other. So for example, this would mean the nearest neighbor springs are attached to one string. This would mean I'm taking other neighboring interactions and so on. Maybe not the exact reason.
Interaction is a multiplication between these
fields. Yes.
The more interaction, the more fields are multiplied.
Exactly. So the harmonic term would mean that if I change this field point, it influences these neighboring points immediate. But higher order would mean that if I change this field point, it would influence the others as well. Something of that sort. Maybe that would have been a reason. Not sure. Yeah.
So I believe the reason why we choose a polynomial potential is that usually in a field theory, you can only go up to a certain order in the powers of the field, otherwise
yeah.
It becomes non-renormalized.
Yes.
Oh. So infinities show up in the theory, and you have terms that are too high ordering the field. So usually there's a technique for like redefining parameters that gets rid of infinities, but you can't do it if there's a term that's too high or not too high.
Now I see why Dirac wasn't happy with the field theory, right? So just do what you can do and make some approximations to get the result. Yeah.
It was just thinking about the linear term in the potential. So I actually think that if it were present, it would give a physical effect because then you would not be expanding the minimum of the potential. But if we sort of solve the equation some more, we're trying to find some like nearby vacuum, then we should like the equation.
Yes, yeah. I agree, yeah. But for our purposes, we're just ignoring it. But I have seen some theories which include this vector as well, and it gives some interesting physics. It's not that it doesn't give you some interesting physics. Yeah.
Maybe I can just add that we can like make a change of variable of phi and make it become phi plus constant, and then do all the expansion, and then use like the new like term proportional to phi resulting from all this big expansion to cancel out the first one we had by choosing our like shift parameter. So that's like the new I can do that.
Okay, yeah. This is the first time I'm doing QFT, you know? That's the first exposure of me having QFT. But yeah, that's something really nice which has been shared. Thank you. So what we need, what we are going to do is we are going to find the Lagrangian for field now. And I'm interested in Z, okay? Remember, we defined what Z is. Okay. So a vacuum state for my field, which means all field points are, they don't have any magnitude, let's say. And I'm just seeing how it propagates from vacuum to vacuum in a time capital T. So I need board. And we'll come back to the slides again because I have some more pictures to show you. So what we need for our amplitude A is the action, right? Because that goes in my phase, and that's how I calculate my path integral. And this action depends on my Lagrangian. And since now I'm replacing Qs by phis, so I'll just write phi and Q phi dots. I need this for my field. And right now it's not correct. And while we are building this Lagrangian for my fields, we'll try to incorporate relativity as well within the field, okay? So what I want is a relativistically correct term here. And this, since we are talking about scalar fields, this should be a scalar invariant or a scalar like Lorentz scalar, I would say. So what I want is my Lagrangian to be a Lorentz scalar quantity. Because I want to take care of the relativity as well here, okay? So there are different approaches to build this this Lagrangian for field. I'm going to use a very intuitive and a very non-mathematically rigorous approach. Since this has to be Lorentz scalar, it should be a function of, so this is, right? And I want it to be Lorentz scalar, so I want to treat time and space at the same footing. So instead of just the time derivative, I'm going to change it to a four-vector derivative, okay? And this is a vector quantity. I want it to be a scalar. So instead of this, I'll say that my Lagrangian is a function of a scalar, which is the inner product of these contravariant and covariant vector. Okay, so this is a scalar quantity, first thing. For phi, I know, let me be more neat. So what we did, we changed phi to a function of not phi and phi dot, but a function of phi and and we already know what function of phi should be here. We just defined the potential for it. So my Lagrangian for the field should be a function of phi and d mu phi, d mu phi, all right? The most general, one more thing here. So this is the Lagrangian at one field point. Remember, we built it from, so we built this from our Lagrangian for the point particle, right? From a point. So this is a Lagrangian, this is the Lagrangian for one field point. I need the Lagrangian for the entire field. So I need to also sum it over all the space points. Okay? This is my complete Lagrangian. And since I'm writing this as L, I'll write this as Lagrangian density. So this Lagrangian density gives me the Lagrangian at one point, and I'm then summing it over the entire space to give me the complete Lagrangian of the field. Is this thing correct? So curly L would be the Lagrangian density. And the general, most general form of my Lagrangian density, which we are going to use, by convention, we choose the factor in front of d mu phi as half and a minus sign with f phi, okay? So this would be our form of Lagrangian density. Let's see how our action looks like. So my action for the fields would be given by and we just define our Lagrangian for the field as so integrated over the entire space, Lagrangian density. Okay? Yes?
I have a naive question.
Yeah, no.
So here, the function f kind of takes the role of path, the q of t, like path in classical mechanics, is that right?
The function f, this function f,
takes the role of path.
It tells the interaction within the field. So it's kind of, this is kind of a kinetic energy term for Lagrangian, and this is a kind of potential energy term for your field. Not exactly, but yeah, something like q dot square, and this is like.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering why we have a function of phi for the first parameter, but not why we don't take the derivative of the function itself.
Oh, okay, like, that should be included in something like the kinetic energy term.
Okay.
Naively speaking, yeah.
Different from classical.
Yeah. Okay, so. This is the action, and since we want our theories to be relativistically correct, this doesn't treat space and time still at the same level, right? Space is integrated over the infinite space and still time doesn't. So I'm just going to change the integration variables from minus t half to t half, and then take time way back in future when the universe was created, and way ahead, way back in past when the universe was created, and way ahead in future when the universe would die. So this is like a kind of path integral from way past to way future, okay?
So we don't have to like change it like that without any
Yeah, I'm not giving any rigorous proof. There are. So there are more rigorous other ways of finding this Lagrangian for a field. But here I haven't given any mathematical rigorous proof. It's just I'm trying to make my Lagrangian to be relativistically correct. That's all. And this trick has been done to make it relativistically correct. Otherwise, it won't be a scalar invariant. Okay? Yeah.
Do you want L to be a Lorentz scalar or the action to be 1? Because now I see that the Lorentz, L, the Lagrangian, is integrated with respect to time. Like a logarithm or something, you want to transform your time differential. Will transform time and you have to like transform L in an opposite way to have S be a yeah.
So I want my what I want is I want my theory should be frame independent. So I want this quantity to be an invariant quantity.
Yes, but then is L an invariant quantity? It has to change to cancel the change in my time variable. Or, and maybe this is wrong. What signature are you using?
What do you mean by signature?
Mostly plus and mostly minus.
For the metric, I think it's minus plus plus plus, but I need to, I'm not sure here. Can you check? I think it's minus plus plus plus. I think so.
Because then maybe there should be maybe like minus.
Ah, okay.
Because you should get like phi dot square plus.
Yes, in here. So do we get, I'm treating this as a positive square. So is it like, I think it should be minus plus 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 then. Can anyone confirm this? I'm bad with this. Okay. Yeah, but I think this quantity here I'm taking as with a positive sign, and does it fit the definition of minus plus 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 or plus minus minus minus?
It depends on how well you work. So, like,
okay.
Is
it important for the discussions ahead, this negative sign? Then I can confirm that maybe tomorrow, Monday. Okay.
A quick question. I'm not entirely convinced by replacing the time derivative with respect to, with phi to the generalized derivative in space and time. I'm not entirely convinced by
it. Why?
So I get the motivation behind it. You want this to be relativistically correct.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I don't really think that we can do this.
What do you want to see? So this, what does this term here tell you? It tells you the variation
with time.
And again, maybe it's the same answer but rephrased. When we are talking about a field, it's just not the time which is varying, it's the space as well. You have a different field point at space. So I think you need to include the variation with other space points as well. It's like rephrasing what I have written here. Maybe you're still not convinced.
So two ways to think about it that I know of is, one, you can just include any terms on the Lagrangian you want and give the coefficients, and then determine what coefficients do you need for it to be a relativistic invariant. And you find that it needs to take this form, so either mostly plus or mostly minus. And then the other way physically is that so there's the time kinetic term, which is just like normal, and then the other term is a gradient potential as well. So if there's spatial variation in the field, it's
exactly. That's what I'm, yeah. Okay. So this is what I'm exactly trying to convey. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. In putting it in a better, like, scientific terminology, but I was exactly trying to say the same thing.
Thank you.
Okay. So any more questions? I think we are going to run out of time, but I won't rush up with things, even though I won't be able to cover a few topics which I wanted to, but let's keep the pace the way it is. Only, I think one person thought that it was too slow, but others were happy with the pace of the course, so. Yeah. So I can write this now as, this action as, in general terms, like, and instead of writing fi every time, I'll just write phi, and instead of writing this complete, just writing this, okay? So it means that this Lagrangian density is a function of phi and d mu phi, okay? And this d here means one dimension for your time and d dimensions for your space, which in this case we were taking as 3, okay? Now my next question is, can I derive or find my quantum mechanics from the quantum field theory? Okay. And how can I do that? So in till now what we have found, let me just write it down. What we found was this probability amplitude, which we are trying to find, not found out. How? So this is the probability amplitude that my field transformed from I to some f. In our particular case, we are interested in a vacuum to vacuum evolution. But this quantity can be written in terms of my action as replacing phi, replacing q with phi, and I've just made this action my Lorentz invariant quantity, okay? So can I change this into my quantum mechanical description? So can I change this into what we did there? Just by simple replacement. Because see, what we did when we changed from here to here, we kind of introduced a symmetry between space and time. We treated space and time at the same footing. And it's clearly easy to see that in this expression for S, if I break that symmetry by taking D as 0, so now I don't have a field, I just have a single point. You'd be easy to retrieve your Q, your Z for the quantum mechanics, okay? Because if you take D as 0, this integration would change to, so if I don't take any space dimension, I'd break that symmetry which I was using. My S for Q, now for single particle, would be, so this would change to dt, and my Lagrangian density, which was a function of d mu phi would just be function of d square Q, and which is my Lagrangian for the quantum mechanical particle. This is nothing too tricky. The main question is, since we are talking about these scalar fields, so the Lagrangian which I have defined here is for my scalar field, can I prove that this, the scalar classical fields, can I, from here, can I deduce that, yes, if I choose my Lagrangian for the scalar field here, for the scalar classical field, do I get Euler-Lagrangian equation, which is true for the classical fields, okay? So what we are trying to do is we are trying to see if I can now deduce classical mechanics from my quantum field theory or not, okay? So let's just do that in last 15 minutes. So let's see how our picture looks like in classical limit. So in classical limit, we just saw that for classical picture, my action is much, much greater than h cross. So if I include h cross here back, which would mean that out of all the phases, there's the classical phase which is contributing the most. That's the path integral least action principle which we did for single particle. But that should be true for our fields as well. So principle of least action should state that any path which deviates from this classically predicted path should be zero. And if I just use standard classical mechanics, and you might have already seen that around. So any small deviation about the classical path should be zero. So from using this fact, let's try to derive the Euler-Lagrangian equation, okay? You probably might have seen it already for single particle, but this is for the field and the mathematical steps are almost same. So what I mean here is that any small deviation from my classical path should not give me any effect, which I can write breaking this into two parts. This is a standard classical mechanical problem, should be written as. And let's assume, and I think it's, there's no harm, can give. So this del also can create some changes with respect to, I think, space-time. And these are also some changes with respect to space-time, I would say. And I can change the order because, naively speaking, you take derivative with respect to x and then y should be equivalent to taking derivative with respect to y and x. So I can switch the orders here. And I'm happy with this part of my action. Let's integrate this by parts, okay? So I'll first replace this by d mu phi. And integrate this by parts. I think treating this as the first function and the second, you'll get two quantities, which would be this is zero because small variations at the boundaries should be zero. And this is what I get. This integral is true for any del phi, which means that the quantity in bracket should be 0, which is my Euler-Lagrangian equation for my field. Okay. And now if I try to substitute, so this is my equation for a classical field. Now if I substitute my Lagrangian density for so this is how we had defined L, right? Let's substitute in here and see what equation we get. Okay, this is my Euler-Lagrangian equation. Now let's substitute the value for R Lagrangian, the scalar field Lagrangian, and see how our equation looks like. I'm going to substitute it here. Let's first find the first part of our Euler-Lagrangian equation. So this is not a function of phi. These terms are function of phi. When I take derivatives, I should get something like this. Now let's calculate the second part. Now L from here, I see that these, they are not function of d mu phi, right? It's just this part which is function of d mu phi. So I'll just all right, which should give me, so I'll take derivative by parts and what I'll get is, and before doing that, I think I should change the quantity here, right? Because I'm taking derivative with respect to a lower index tensor. What are they called? Contravariant or covariant? Is this a contravariant vector or covariant vector?
Covariant.
Covariant vector. So I'm taking derivative with respect to a covariant vector. I'll make this a covariant vector as well by using metric. Okay. So I'll use the fact that g of alpha beta should give me d alpha phi. Okay, it's the metric tensor. So I'll use the fact here. And g alpha should not depend on this, so I can just write it here, okay? Okay, now I can integrate it by parts, it will give me two terms, okay? And this quantity here is a delta function, right? Because this is going to survive only when mu is equal to alpha. So I can write it as delta alpha mu, and this quantity as a delta function of beta mu. Okay. And which means this is D and this is G, which means that I can write this as this Euler-Lagrangian equation. So it becomes, from there, it becomes half d mu okay. So this is my second term here. I'll substitute this and my curly L by curly phi in my Euler-Lagrangian equation here, both the terms, and what I'll get in the end is and this is my equation for equation of motion for a scalar classical field. Okay. And if I ignore the enharmonic terms, just include the, I'll just include the term up to phi in my equation of motion. This is a Klein-Gordon equation. Okay. Yeah. Is there a question? All right. I want to show, time is already running short. I want to show a few more slides and then I think we are just perfectly on time. Okay, so what we just did, we change our path integral formulation for particles to scalar fields by making our Lagrangian Lorentz invariant and redefined a quantity called Lagrangian density, and then saw how it changes into quantum mechanics and Euler-Lagrangian equation. But the entire transition amplitude which we are trying to now find, it involves number of integrals. See how the picture is evolving, how the picture actually looks like is that you have time evolution of single field point, and it could take any infinite paths to evolve from one point to other, and then you have infinite of these field points. So they're like infinite integrations, and in the end what you get is just the probability amplitude after doing so many infinite integrations, okay? So all that just for a drop of blood, just a single number. So to visualize it, let's say that this is my field evolving over time. So temperature, it's changing at a different period of time. And let's look at one of these field points. This is how single field point should evolve from our quantum mechanics, right? So single field point has infinite paths of evolving and then becoming phi f at that point. But then it's not just the evolution of single field point we are talking about. All these field points are evolving this way. So there are like infinite paths for my field to evolve at each point. Okay, I'll give you a second or minute, not second, maybe 15 seconds to just get this in your head, that there are so many integrations involved. Okay, and then we saw that in quantum mechanics, we can derive our quantum mechanics from QFT, and also in classical limits, it looks like the Klein-Gordon equation for our scalar fields. Nothing interesting so far. What we are going to do in our lecture on Monday would be, we are just going to consider the field, the terms up to phi. We are not going to take higher order terms in here, okay? Which would mean that in our Lagrangian, I'm just considering the harmonic part of the interaction, m square phi square, and I'm ignoring the enharmonic terms, which are like cubes of phi and higher orders, okay? And such a field means a free field, okay? We're going to call this now as a scalar free field. And as I said in my starting lecture, just including that particular term, phi square term, means that now I'm trying to visualize my field as a bunch of harmonic oscillators only. There's the harmonic term, phi square term, only in my field, okay? I'm ignoring the higher enharmonicities. Monday's lecture, we are going to talk about something like source. So if you just think about what we are trying to see right now is a quantity called z, the amplitude. Amplitude of what? Of my field evolving from nothing to nothing. So this doesn't sound something interesting, right? My time evolution operator, this Hamiltonian here, would ideally do nothing to my field because this is an eigenstate for H. And remember, eigenstates are stationary. So they shouldn't move. If something is in vacuum, it should remain in vacuum if I observe it over a period of time. Doesn't sound anything exciting. So what we are going to do on Monday is we are going to disturb this field a bit. Okay? In a way, you have those bunch of harmonic oscillators, and I'm trying to maybe disturb one of the harmonic oscillator in my field and then see what effects it produces. Okay, and this disturbance will be called as the source term or the J term in my Lagrangian. Any questions? This is the end of the lecture.